This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A different twist on EcoShock this week, we go radioactive. While major media goes into denial hyperspin, the public and Greens are making a difference. You'll hear about the victories over insane expansion of coal-fired power plants in the United States. It's grassroots, it's bigger than the anti-nuclear movement of the 70s, and it's grossly underreported. Author Ted Nace explains the high-tech tools and old-fashioned grit that stopped the construction of at least 90 more coal plants in America. That's good news for the climate and hope for us all. Then we'll get a sneak preview from journalist and military specialist Gwyn Dyer. The military and politicians know climate is shifting much faster than anyone expected. Why haven't they told the public the truth?
Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. I've interviewed dozens of scientists telling us time is running out before a major planetary shift in the climate, not to mention a mass extinction of species. It's time to do something. And despite what you've heard, activism is still alive in America. Let's talk with Ted Nace, author of the book Climate Hope, on the front lines of the fight against coal. Hello, Ted.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good. And I want to start out, in case there's somebody out there who still doesn't know, asking, why is coal on the front lines of climate activism instead of, say, oil?
Well, the argument has really been articulated best, I think, by James Hansen, who's the head climate scientist for the federal government, works for NASA. What he points out is that although coal is about a third of the emissions from fossil fuels, the reason that it's the main target for people trying to do something about climate change is that the reserves of coal in the ground are so much larger than they are for the other fossil fuels. So, even if we were to burn through all of our conventional supplies of oil and gas, there's really not enough left to hugely affect the climate. But there is enough coal to do that. And so coal, a moratorium on new coal plants and a phase out of coal by 2030 has been identified as the strategy for stopping the worst effects of climate change.
And aside from coal's threat to the climate, it hurts and kills people outright. Could you tell us briefly about that?
Well, yeah, anything we do on the climate front will result in a lot of benefits for public health. In the United States, about 25,000 people a year die prematurely from coal-related respiratory problems, heart attacks. It's estimated that on the average, those people are losing 14 years of life. So it's costing hundreds of thousands of person years and just the general quality of life. On top of that, there's the mercury problem. Coal is the primary source of mercury in the environment, and it's estimated that about 600,000 women in the United States give birth with elevated levels of mercury in their bloodstream, which has all kinds of negative effects on infants and children.
So this gets really personal. Well, Ted, your previous book was about gangs in America. How did you get involved in this coal story?
Well, the title of the book, of my previous book, was Gangs of America, and the subtitle was The Rise of Corporate Power and the Disabling of Democracy. And really, those two subjects for me are linked, the corporate power issue and the environment issue, because, in the United States, the fossil fuel industries and other industries have had such an inordinate ability to affect the political process. And, in many ways, a lot of environmental activism sort of addresses the symptoms of industrial activity. But if we're really going to get to the root of it, we really have to look at the corporate control over our government. And so I see those subjects as really closely related. In the United States, they talk about big coal, king coal. The coal industry actually isn't that large on a monetary basis. It's about the size of Walmart in Texas. But because the coal industry has gotten so good at playing politics and put so much of its money into the political process, it's been able to really have an overwhelming effect on the political process in the United States.
And it seems that in 2007, people found out that there were plans to build 151 new coal-fired power plants. And once that was exposed, what was the reaction of the biggest Washington environment groups?
Well, this is a really interesting story because it's a story about people, at the grassroots doing what they thought needed to be done. at the Washington level, the big environmental organizations have been largely passive or have really focused on sort of overarching legislative solutions that don't really get at the specifics of what's going on. And after the 150 coal plants were proposed and climate scientists pointed out what a disaster this would be for, you know, for any attempt to rein in climate change, literally hundreds of groups mobilized across the country at the local level, at the state level. And there were a couple of national groups that got involved. One was the Sierra Club and one was the Rainforest Action Network that really focused on stopping these coal plants. But without that grassroots movement, there really wouldn't have been the kind of progress that we've seen. And really, this is one of the most positive stories that come out of the environmental movement in decades, because by now, out of those 151 plants, at least 95 have been stopped.
Well, as you know, Ted, the media's been very hard on NIMBY. As soon as you say, not in my backyard, well, that sort of disposes of the argument. But you seem to be saying these local actions are really the key to the new activism.
Well, what's different, I'd say, than just the sort of the very myopic sort of NIMBY that people have a negative association with, is that the groups are working on proposed local projects. And yes, they are concerned about the local effects. And in all politics, in that way, is local. But at the same time, these groups are networked together, and they're working jointly on this problem that really has global significance, which is climate change. So there's no real inconsistency between trying to stop a project that's going to wreck your local air quality and also doing something that's going to protect, you know, future generations from climate change.
And I know the idea of clean coal has been pretty successful, even though it doesn't exist anywhere. Even Obama talked about it during the 2008 campaign. Let's take one example, that coal gasification technology. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. Clean coal is a term that's been around for at least 100 years, and the coal industry always uses it for whatever is the latest attempt to make coal somewhat livable. And in the old days, it was the hard coal, anthracite, which burns relatively clean. And then in the 1970s, when people began worrying about conventional pollutants like sulfur dioxide that causes acid rain and other things, then clean coal meant coal plants that were equipped with at least a modicum of scrubber technology. And then most recently, clean coal started to mean the hypothetical new coal plants that would capture carbon, so that wouldn't contribute to climate change. There's several technologies for getting there. The one that was talked about the most was called IGCC, which stands for Integrated Gasification Combined Cycle. And basically all that means is they turn the coal into gas, and then they burn the gas to make electricity. It has promise, but it also is not there yet. And it's also expected to be extremely expensive. And really, when you take into account all the expenses of turning the coal into gas and then burning the gas and then taking the carbon that you've been able to isolate out and pumping it deep underground and then monitoring it and keeping it underground for centuries, what it all comes down to is that it would be cheaper to build solar plants and wind plants anyway. And even when you create this coal-based electrical generating technology that might avoid climate change, you still haven't solved the problem of really devastating mining techniques like mountaintop removal. So it all seemed like a very, very complicated way to avoid the simple step of just moving off of coal onto friendlier technologies. And so anti-coal groups weren't impressed with it as a solution, even though some of the large environmental groups were. And they targeted these gasification projects, really in the same way that they targeted more conventional coal plants. And most of the gasification projects have also been stopped.
And they were talking about building a whole new pipeline system to move this carbon slurry around and, you know, a sort of Yucca Mountain kind of thing, or putting it old oil fields. And as you say, there was really no guarantee that this CO2 was going to stay in the ground or might not just come out 100 years later to wreck the climate for future generations.
Right. And, you know, this is still a project internationally because industry likes the idea. But as you say, it would involve a whole new infrastructure of pipelines. I mean, they're talking about a quantity of pipelines that would exceed all of the oil pipelines that exist now just to keep coal going. And coal is running out. A lot of the coal that's left can only be accessed through very, very destructive mining technologies. So eventually we're going to have to make the jump over to greener ways of creating electricity and more efficient ways of providing our power needs. So really, why not make the transition now? Why wait until we've really created so much more devastation, you know, in terms of nature, in terms of the climate? And this has been just the simple, straightforward step that has been advocated by these groups.
And the obvious question, which you do cover well in your book, is this: why should Americans stop building coal-fired power plants if the Chinese are going to build them like crazy? I'm sure you get that one a lot.
I hear that one a lot, and it's almost an excuse not to do anything in the United States if people point out, well, they're building one or even two power plants in China every week. The answer to that really has to do with how much coal is in China. China is not does not have big coal reserves. They have about the same amount of coal as in the state of Montana. The United States really is the Saudi Arabia of coal and is the only country that by itself can really create devastating climate change from coal. China is not going to do it because China is going to run out of coal before they get there. Now, the Chinese could import to some extent, but even that's limited. And what we see is that China is sort of moving through the Industrial Revolution at hyperspeed. So they're in their coal phase now, but they're moving much faster into wind and solar than right now. China's become the international leader in manufacturing wind turbines, for example, and that just happened in a very short span of time. In 3 or 4 years, they jumped from, you know, something like fifth or sixth into the number one position. So because the Chinese economy is so dynamic and is capable of moving so quickly, we may be complaining about Chinese coal plants, and China may have already completely moved into solar technology. So, yeah, China is being used mostly as an excuse, and it's not a very good one. Really, the United States produces something like four times as much carbon dioxide per person than China does, even now, despite all this Chinese coal.
And, you know, American activism has been declared dead so many times. People just point to Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, or the decline of anti-war rallies. And that's why I think your book is so important. Why has the new organizing gone under the radar of the mainstream media?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about the anti-coal movement is that it has been a red state phenomenon. A lot of it's occurring in places that are normally written off as, you know, conservative backwaters, places where people don't care, places where people are automatically conservative. You have to know the United States better and to stop making those kind of generalities and to stop, you know, gathering all your conclusions from places like Fox News or the mainstream media in general, because so much is happening in local communities across the United States. And it's not true that based on what this movement has done and how much it's mobilized at the local level, it's just not true that people don't band together and get active. I mean, it's happening more now than ever. And in fact, if you compare the anti-coal movement to the anti-nuclear movement of the 1980s, 1970s and 1980s, actually there have been more coal plants canceled than nuclear plants were ever canceled. So, you know, it's a very hopeful indication of where real people are at out there and what they're really doing when they, you know, just decide to take matters into their own hands. It's sort of a counter-narrative to this generally pessimistic narrative about climate that just looks at the lack of progress on international treaties and the lack of progress on national climate legislation in the United States. And it's not incompatible with those goals. When there's mobilization at the grassroots around individual coal plants or coal mines or coal waste sites, that kind of energy can add up to something at the national level as well. But even if there's not progress at the national level, so much has been accomplished at the local level in terms of getting rid of plans for new coal plants and also beginning to phase out the existing fleet of coal plants.
Can you give us an example of one of those grassroots groups that we might not have heard about that did win their fight?
Oh, boy, there's been so many. Let me just talk about one state, which would be really surprising to people, which is Kansas, one of the most conservative states in the country. And in fact, a fellow named Robert Frank wrote a book called What's the Matter with Kansas, which just scratched its head over why Kansas was so conservative. Well, the fact of the matter is that people mobilized in Kansas just as they have in so many other places, and they didn't expect to win. They just mobilized because they were so disturbed by the prospect of these giant new coal plants being built. They managed to enlist the support of the governor, and they defeated the coal plant. The state legislature was mostly in the hands of the energy industry. The state legislature would overrule the governor. The governor would veto the state legislature, and it went back and forth several times, but the governor finally prevailed. Well, that's just one example. Another example is Florida, where because of the number of hurricanes that have hit Florida, you actually have a place in the United States where most people have really made the connection between climate change and energy use. And the person who really made the difference there was a Republican, Governor Charlie Crist, who sent his aides out to put pressure on the electric utilities to stop building coal plants, and they ended up canceling all the coal plants in Florida. Another example is the billionaire investor Warren Buffett. This is a story that really should be told in the business press, because it's about how one of the best thinkers on business strategy came to the conclusion that coal was a bad deal. He had been planning in late 2007 to build 6 or 7 coal plants, and within a year and a half, he had canceled all those coal plants. And I was very interested in what his rationale was, you know, because this is, he generally operates on pretty strict business principles. When I looked into it, I couldn't identify any one single thing that pushed Buffett into canceling his coal, but what it was a political movement across the board, from very radical sort of direct action by young people, you know, such as blockades and lockdowns, to much more conventional mainstream environmental lobbying, you know, regulatory interventions, lawsuits, to state legislation that pushed for lower levels of carbon in electrical generation. All these things sort of converged and pushed Buffett into, you know, really going away from coal. And I think of him as a bellwether in the business community. You know, there's a lot of businessmen who take their strategic direction from Buffett, and hopefully they're also beginning to see the handwriting on the wall economically.
We are talking with Ted Nace about the people who do something to help prevent a climate catastrophe. Ted is a publisher, a journalist, and author of the book Climate Hope on the Front Lines of the Fight Against Coal. Ted, can you give us an update? Where is the fight now, and is there hope that cleaner energy will displace this black danger?
Yeah, well, you know, I focus so much on the negative side because it is a prerequisite for the positive. The negative side is to stop these new coal plants and to get rid of the existing ones. But that presupposes that there's a positive alternative in it, and there definitely is. You know, one of the bright spots is the progress that's been made on coming up with solar technologies that don't depend on the sun shining. And so often, alternative energy is kind of given, you know, given short shrift because people say, well, what do we do when the, you know, when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing? Well, some of the new technological developments have been ways of storing the heat of the sun so that you can continue to get power from a solar farm well into the evening or even 24/7. That has to do with heating up water during the day into these large underground sort of thermoses, and then letting the heat or the steam out from these pressurized hot water or reservoirs, you know, all through the night. Well, if we can generate, economically generate power like that from solar energy, then we really have a base load source of energy that can replace coal. And this is not just hypothetical. These plants have been built in Spain and in California and Nevada. Likewise, the progress on wind has been really astonishing. In 2008, there were actually more people building wind farms than were mining coal. So we have a big new energy sector rising up, sort of out of the ashes, literally, of a declining one. This is one of those great sort of watersheds of economic change, you know, that happen every, you know, every few decades. If it wasn't for the amount of propaganda being put out by the coal industry, it would be more obvious to people that really the progress is happening, and people can be hopeful. But you really need both things to happen. You need, on the one hand, to be promoting this new technology, but on the other hand, there needs to be action to stop and get rid of the old technology, because otherwise these coal plants that, you know, were built in the 50s and 60s, these dirty old coal plants that keep running very cheaply, you know, will just keep chugging along and they'll never be shut down.
And I understand that in order to keep track of this very complicated process, you and other activists had to develop some new tools using the Internet. Can you briefly tell us about that?
Well, that's been one of the things that's made grassroots activism just so much more effective, these very simple Internet tools. You know, the one that we work on is a clearinghouse of information that we put online. It's called Coal Swarm, and it's like an online encyclopedia of all the different things going on in this world of activism. There, we have separate pages of information on each coal plant, each coal mine, each coal waste site, every company doing coal. And it's the same technology that was used to create Wikipedia, the online database that anyone can contribute to. So we use the same principle of open access and collaboration. Anybody can post information onto our clearinghouse of information, and anybody can use the information, including people from industry. So this sort of open, collaborative information sharing really reflects a movement that doesn't have sort of centralized leadership. It's an anarchic process, but a really effective one. And I think it's a great model for activism in general. When you can link people together in ways that empower a broad number of people instead of creating some kind of centralized activist army that just focuses on, say, Washington legislation. When you can create this sort of broad-based movement, then you've got something that can really scale up and that can really be powerful, you know, not just for getting, say, federal legislation or international climate legislation happening, but really for working at the community level to make these transitions that involve people's jobs and people's lives, you know, just daily life in everyday communities across the country. So I guess what I'm saying is that the internet is not a solution here, but it's been a tool that's helped shape the nature of the movement in a really beneficial way.
Can you give our listeners the URL, the sites where people can find out more about your work and this continuing battle against coal?
Our site is called Coal Swarm, just one word, COALSWARM, Coal Swarm, like a swarm of bees. And that's to reflect the sort of decentralized nature of the movement. So, yeah, they can go to coalswarm.org. And I also refer them to places like the Alliance for Appalachia or the Sierra Club, so many groups working on it. If they go to our website, they'll see a list of over 300 groups working on coal.
All righty. And finally, you alluded to a change in the campaign where activists are looking less at new coal plant construction and more at shutting down existing stations, and that might even take some civil disobedience. How is that going?
Well, it's really almost, you'd have to say it's ahead of schedule because the climate scientists have sort of given us the year 2030 as our deadline, to get rid of these 600 old plants, and they are old. The average plant was built in 1964. So it's older than the average activist. But so far, about 50 of these plants have been scheduled for being phased out just in the last year or so. That's remarkable progress. And, you know, we have some time to go, and progress continues. Yeah, I'm very hopeful. And it's a different kind of activism because you're talking about communities that have become dependent on these plants that need a good transition plan. It's not just about, you know, you don't want to create a situation where you're just throwing people out of work. You really need in every community that's affected by coal for there to be some thought as to how to make a transition. So, for example, in the Coal River in West Virginia, activists got together and developed plans for a wind farm using the same using the ridges there, which have very powerful wind sources. The same's been done in New Mexico, where they shut down the Mojave plant, but at the same time there was a very broad-based campaign to create jobs doing solar energy. So people need to be thinking at this level of detail all across the country, and they're starting to do that.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Ted Nace, author of the book Climate Hope, On the Front Lines of the Fight Against Coal. Ted became pivotal to this new activism, helping tie together many local actions into a national presence. So thank you for your time and your work, Ted.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Dr. Gwynn Dyer has a degree in military and Middle Eastern history. He served in three navies and advised military colleges from Sandhurst to Oxford. Dyer is also a famous war journalist who lately dove into climate change with a book and three-part radio series called Climate Wars. Our speech clips were recorded at a presentation by Vancouver Community College Arts and Science, February 2, 2010. After talking with many top scientists, politicians, and generals, Dyer's first conclusion is chilling. Climate change is moving much faster than the public has been told.
It's moving a lot faster than the public discussion recognizes. Public discussion, if you look at, for example, the Copenhagen conference that went aground last December, actually didn't go in and run aground, it sank with all hands. But if you look at the numbers they were using at the Copenhagen conference to describe the scale and speed of the problem, they were basically numbers taken from the 2007 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC for short, which essentially said, look, we can't tell you exactly how much warming we're going to have because that depends on how much economic growth we have over the next, you know, decades, but here's the range of possibilities for 2100, the end of the century. We might have as little as 1.8 degrees of warming, Celsius, of course, or we might have as much as 5.6 degrees. Well, you know, that's like the doctor telling you, well, it could be hangnail or it could be lung cancer. Because 1.8 degrees is sort of within the bounds, and, you know, 90 years to adapt to it, I can deal with that, I think. Whereas 5.6 degrees is three-quarters of the human race dead because you can't feed the population anymore. Most of the farmland in the world turned into desert. Wide variation. But even the higher number was okay if you're telling me that's what happens if you don't get on the problem before 2100. You know, we still got 90 years to deal with it. So while these are moderately alarming figures, they are not cause for immediate panic and certainly not going to give the soldiers anything to do soon. Unfortunately, they're not the right numbers. Because what they leave out is the feedbacks. And the feedbacks finally got calculated in by the Hadley Center on Climate Change, which is the big British research center, probably the of the big three, the most important one. They published numbers, actually the British government published the numbers because it runs the Hadley Center, just before the Copenhagen conference opened in December. The Hadley Center said, yeah, but, never mind the IPCC numbers, if we continue on the present course, business as usual, which doesn't mean no attempts to control our emissions, but just the sort of attempts we've made so far. A little bit of conservation, change the light bulbs, more fuel-efficient cars, 3% cuts in emissions, whatever. Well, no, we're offering 4% cuts. Then, really, given the feedbacks, we will hit 4 degrees hotter by 2060. Which is a whole different ballgame. 4 degrees hotter is a global average. First of all, when you talk about these numbers, we're not talking about the difference between a warm day and a relatively warmer day. You ought to think about it in the same way you think about your own body temperature, right? And if you got 2 degrees higher than normal body temperature, you've got a fever. And if you got 5.6 degrees higher than your normal body temperature, you're dead. And 4 degrees global average temperature actually translates into something a good deal scarier in terms of where we live, which is basically on the land surface of the planet. Two-thirds of the world is oceans, and oceans are relatively cool. So to get that average of 4 degrees, what you're doing is you're working between an average over the oceans of maybe 2.5 degrees hotter and an average over land of 5 to 7 degrees hotter. Further inland you go, further away from the cooling influence of the oceans, the higher the temperature. So 4 degrees higher. They actually put a map out, the Hadley Center, with this forecast, which showed you how much the real warming would be in various land portions of the globe. And it's kind of bad news for inland Canada, the prairies, Ontario, and Quebec, because it actually works out at 7 degrees higher. I don't know if it's even raining at 7 degrees higher in the places it rains now where we grow the food. And I certainly don't want to be there when the power browns out in the summer because the dams behind the hydro aren't full anymore and there's no air conditioning. The coastal areas like, you know, BC and the Maritimes, Newfoundland, notice how I mentioned them separately, I grew up in Newfoundland. The coastal areas aren't quite so badly hit because you've got the cooling influence of the ocean, so the lower mainland of Vancouver Island are probably only having to deal with 5 degrees hotter. Britain gets away with 3 degrees hotter in a 4 degree hotter world. They're lucky. But there aren't many lucky places. So the real situation, and this is the numbers the military are working with, is much more urgent, much scarier, and likely to produce jobs for them much sooner.
That was author and broadcaster Gwyn Dyer from A Work in Development, Climate Wars.
This is Radio EcoShock.